You're listening to Trek FM.
Hello and welcome to episode 17 of Commentary Trek Stars, a show which deals with the work of Star Trek creators outside of Star Trek. I'm Mike.
I'm Max.
And today we are going to be taking a look at Nicholas Meyer as a novelist on the whole.
A retrospectival.
Mm-hmm. We've covered all six of his novels, and now we are going to recap them one by one and sort of try to draw some sort of conclusions as to his career as a novelist. So, he wrote six books, and...
Conclusion! Wrote six books.
The six books were Target Practice, The 7% Solution, The West End Horror, Black Orchid, Confessions of a Homing Pigeon, and The Canary Trainer.
Mm-hmm. He likes birds.
Mm-hmm. So let's just get started with number one, 1974, Target Practice. This was a book about a detective, a private detective during the Watergate scandal. It was written during the Watergate scandal, and he's investigating the reasons behind the suicide or apparent suicide of a soldier who had.
It's not like a mystery or anything. He just straight up killed himself. That's right.
Yeah.
Not covering anything up.
Who had just returned from Vietnam?
Mm-hmm. It's Chinatown, but instead of covering up a murder and various nefarious dealings, it's a murder and various nefarious dealings that happened in Vietnam.
Yeah. So, what were your thoughts on Target Practice?
I've read a lot of books that have detective characters as the protagonists, and I've read a lot of mysteries. This one didn't really hook me or anything. I've got older uncles, so I've heard a lot of people rant about Vietnam. And I, generally speaking, I'm not really interested in it because I think the cultural narrative is that was a stupid thing to do. And I agree. So I don't really need somebody to convince me that it was a stupid place or a stupid time.
Right, but you have to look at it in the historical context. I mean, this was written... in 1974, so...
I don't have to look at it in historical context. I mean, if I wanted to do that, if I wanted to say that it was well-written for its time, that's fine, but it doesn't hold up.
Okay.
It's too dated by the material.
I mean, I disagree. I thought it was quite good. I really like how they... how he used sort of old-style detective fiction tropes in order to tell this extraordinarily modern... for the time story. And I think it's also really interesting when you look at the parallels between that and the other book which he wrote in 1974, which is The 7% Solution. That was his first Sherlock Holmes book. It was the one where Holmes meets Freud and gets off the junk, if you will. What did you think about that book?
It really is a book about Holmes getting off of drugs,
mm-hmm.
which is a totally bizarre thing to do. And while reading it, I know my reaction was, this is not really the story. And then somebody gets murdered, and I was like, it's kind of late for that to happen.
But see, that's the thing, is it is really the story. And at the same time, they felt the need to, or he felt the need, to put a mystery on top of it. Well, I think that's kind of where it fails, because the mystery is not nearly as good as the story of Holmes... getting clean.
See, I disagree, because I think that Holmes getting clean isn't actually a story.
I think it is. I mean, I think the way they do that.
There's like no arc to that. I mean, essentially, there's a, like, the titular 7% solution.
No, because,
is essentially a way of getting around the whole, difficulties of getting off of drugs thing.
No, but, they talk about him, going there, convincing him to be there and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And then, they have that scene at the end where he's hypnotized and you get the big reveal to Holmes's past. But regardless of that, if that's the story that you're going to tell, it's kind of, I'm not going to say weird, because it's more typical than anything, to graft a very traditional Holmes mystery onto it.
I know what you're saying. You're saying that it's that it was unnecessary to add the murder element. And I'm saying that neither one is particularly well-founded. Neither one has a great foundation for a story. The murder is tacked on. The criminal element of the story is forced into the story. And the problem is, because if you exclude that, then you more or less have a diary of somebody getting off of drugs, which doesn't really have much of an arc.
Okay. So I guess here's a question for you. When we were initially talking about doing a series on Nicholas Meyer, you know, one of the things which you said that you absolutely wanted to cover, and the reason why we chose novels, was the 7% solution.
Mm-hmm.
I know that you had read it before.
Yeah.
And now, you know, you reread it now. Does your memory of what you thought of it, like, did that change? Did your opinion of the book change on this reading? Are you not as fond of it as you remember being?
I really like the idea that somebody made the 7% solution. I like that the role it plays in, like, the Sherlock Holmes canon. But I mean, like, ultimately, if you're saying, like, that it's a good read, it isn't.
Mm-hmm.
It's broken. Like, it's incredibly bottom heavy, and the story, when it gets started, doesn't really have a lot going for it. But there's work done essentially in the prologue,
mm-hmm,
that is fascinating. And for me, for my money, after I know that, there's really not much more reason to go into it.
Okay.
Because after that prologue, which does an amazing amount of really interesting stuff to the Sherlock Holmes canon, there's not a whole lot there.
Okay, yeah, I kind of agree with that. You know, that's pretty much my opinion on it. Like, I was really interested in what it was they were doing. I keep on saying they. What it was
the royal they.
What it was he was doing, but the end result, if you look at it just as a piece of work on its own, it's not that tremendously good. I still enjoyed it. I still think it is good, but it doesn't work as a cohesive whole as much as some of his other books do.
Oh, I enjoy it plenty. I just don't think it's good.
2 years later, after the very, very huge success of the 7% solution, Meyer returned to Sherlock Holmes for a much more traditional story. Mm. I think you could argue his most traditional Holmes story, The West End Horror, in 1976.
At the same time, kind of not traditional at all.
Well, we'll get into that in a second, but this put Holmes in the theater scene at the time. He interacts with a lot of prominent theater people from that era, including George Bernard Shaw,
Gilbert and Sullivan, Bram Stoker.
So what? Why would you say that this is, in some ways, not a typical Holmes story?
This story, like, there basically is no clue. I mean, the initial crime that is being investigated has one potentially, possibly a clue piece of information. And not until literally like the last 10 pages is that clue explained.
Mm-hmm.
And until that point, they basically go from place to place coming up with hypotheses to explain that clue that connected to the situation that they're in. So more or less, somebody gets murdered, and then Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson run around London for a while, hanging out in various places and meeting weird people. So it's not like a typical Holmes novel, because, I mean, the few that there are didn't have even close to that kind of bizarre bubble-like structure.
But comparing it to 7% Solution and Canary Trainer, which we'll get to later on, to me, this seems like, out of the three, the most typical, because obviously, with 7% Solution, you have a large portion of that story dedicated to Holmes getting clean. And in The Canary Trainer, you basically don't have Watson.
Yeah, except the thing is, like, not having Watson, that's not that atypical. And, I mean, it's difficult to explain, but, like, I consider Canary Trainer to be almost dead on Sherlock Holmes format.
Well, we'll get to that in a second. For me, The West End Horror worked pretty well. I liked the mystery involved, and I think that in terms of, you know, structure and everything, it was a lot more solid than 7% Solution. I don't think that it had as much going for it in terms of content, but as just a typical sort of mystery story, I enjoyed it.
Well, there's a similar thing going on in all of these books where it's Nicholas Meyer showing how much research he's done into the material, because the 7% Solution shows a rather intricate researching of landmarks, geography, and you know, various historical places and their relative positioning. And the West End Horror does that about 10 times more intricately with essentially the entire West End of London.
Mm-hmm.
And that's pretty impressive.
Moving on, in 1978, he co-wrote a novel with Barry J. Kaplan called Black Orchid.
Yes.
This was a pretty big departure for him. It was his first novel, which wasn't detective fiction. It was much more of sort of a romance, adventure, historical fiction piece about an adventurer from America who's sent in by the British government to Brazil in order to try to break up the rubber monopoly and free some oppressed people. Incidentally, I guess, you know, it's more about not having to pay a lot for tires and stuff. What did you think about Black Orchid?
This is a very strange novel. And it's strange in that it's exceptionally typical of the sort of genre that it's in, which is an odd way to describe something as strange, but it is strange for this guy, for Nicholas Meyer, to be doing this, because it is oddly exactly what I would expect from this material. Halfway through this book, the story starts, and then, like 30 pages from the end, you know why you were reading this book.
Mm-hmm.
But until then, it's pretty much hanging out in Brazil or on a boat.
Yeah, I mean, I don't agree with that assessment so much. You know, I think that the stuff that's going on early on is important.
Well, you described it as a gear shift, and if it's a gear shift, it is a gear shift from, like, 1 to 2.
Maybe. I mean, it's not a huge gear shift, but it does definitely take a turn at some point. But
takes a very leisurely turn down a very large and slow-moving river.
Okay. I liked it. I think it had some its fair share of problems. I mean, it's much too long, and I think most of the time, which is spent in error, is spent on description, which is not at all necessary, and actually not very good either. Let's move on to his fifth book, which was released in 1981, which was called Confessions of a Homing Pigeon. Now, this book apparently was semi-autobiographical. It's about a kid whose parents were killed in a circus accident.
Yes.
And he's sent to France to live with his drunk uncle, and then he's sent back to America to live with his other aunt and uncle,
mm-hmm.
and he decides that he needs to run away and go find his drunk uncle in France again, find his home.
Yeah, that's the thing you're saying, and I don't, we went over this in the episode, I really do not think that it's a story. I mean, like, the story is a kid whose parents died when he was very young, who went from family to family and never really fit in anywhere, decided to run away from his home in Chicago. And he decided to go visit somebody that he knew when he was younger, his Uncle Fritz.
Well, sure. No, I guess I'm thinking of it more from the character perspective, you know?
And I think that the character perspective is fairly well delineated as being a kid who has his first conscious decision, his first self-independent, his first real decision as a person, a complete person, is to run away from home. And that's where the story starts. Yeah. And before then, it's basically all flashback.
So what were your thoughts on Confessions of a Homing Pigeon?
I don't read these kinds of books. I'm not really interested in, people, you know, exposing their awkward moments of their childhood, and it really is kind of like a childhood book. It's a book sort of about, you know, a person's childhood, which is why it sort of has a lot of little episodes that feel very accurate to, like, what it feels like to be a kid. Because if you ever remember what it was like to be a kid, it was filled with awkwardness and difficult, painful moments that you didn't entirely know why things were happening, and that's just how it went. And you know, exposing all of that, it makes for, you know, a very personal experience for the author. And when you're reading it, you can tell, yeah, that feels real. I imagine that happened. That sucks. And at the same time, I understand how that shapes a person. At the same time, I understand why I don't read these books. I'm not interested in this. I want to read something that I learn something from. And, like, so much of this book felt like, hey, I remember when I was a kid. That was awful.
Well, I think what that does, and one of the reasons why I liked it, is because the fictionalized version of Nicholas Meyer's childhood made me reflect on my own childhood. And that was something that I really responded to, probably more than anything else in his, dare we say, canon. It's not the best written book, but it did have the biggest impact on
See, me. That to me is just like, I mean, that's what you feel when you read a book that's like that. I mean, it's just, it's an arbitrary kind of emotion. It's like, it's, you're drawing on like an emotion that everybody has because everyone has these shared childhood. Everyone has a very similar sort of experience of growing up because childhood is basically a process of disillusionment of like, oh, everything's fine. And like, oh crap, things die. And then, oh crap, I'm getting older. And oh crap, I'll never be 8 again. And like, so like, if you capture that feeling, those little moments of childhood as you become an adult, like it's going to resonate with the reader because that's just what happens. It's like a trick. It's like you're hacking the brain of the reader by saying, yeah, you know what that felt like. It was hard, right? Feel the emotion. I made that happen. No. My name's on the book. I made that happen. And you know what? I feel that's cheap.
It's not just about feeling the emotion. It's about, you know, making you think about why you're feeling the emotion.
And this book does not have anything in there that gives you any new information. If you've ever read one of these books before, you've already had those moments.
Maybe. Maybe not. Or maybe, you know, every once in a while you need a refresher. You need to read one of these books in order to experience that again. I don't know.
I'm inclined to say that every generation needs one of those. It's not in time with my generation or anyone I know.
I don't know. I think that this story was rather timeless. And, you know, it did definitely strike a chord with me. I didn't feel it was cheap at all, and
I feel like the entire genre is cheap. I feel like the entire genre of like you know, coming of age stories of kids, and in you know the real world dealing with their problems. I think the entire genre is cheap. Well, I think it's essentially manipulation of the readership by saying like you all have these similar experiences. Relate to this character because you've had similar experiences to them. To me, that's kind of like cheating. I mean, essentially, you're not putting in any work into it. You're just saying, like, you're also a person.
Well, I think this is kind of an extension of the discussion which we've had for the past 12, 13 years mm-hmm. about, you know, books or movies like this, you know, things which are very sort of... character, or if you want to call them, you know, emotionally based, you know, and I know that you're not a big fan of them. I mean, the big one that always, you know, comes up, I guess, would be Magnolia because of how much I love that movie.
Yeah, except, I mean, like, my problem with Magnolia is that it's not about anything. I mean, mostly, like, what I'm objecting to is the idea that I'm supposed to say something is good because it made me feel something.
Right, but, like, no. And the idea that Magnolia is not about anything, I think, is absolutely insane.
No, I'm saying that it's about really superficial emotional interactions.
Yeah.
It's about exactly the kind of emotions that you can draw on a single piece of paper using caricatures.
Yeah, totally disagree. But that's okay. We're not talking about Magnolia today, luckily. Right. So let's move on to his next book then, which was The Canary Trainer, his final book, which he wrote 12 years later in 1993. It's also his final Sherlock Holmes book. And this one picks up sort of where 7% Solution left off. Holmes is in his great hiatus, and he goes to France to reinvent himself.
Hideout
and reinvent himself.
He doesn't intend to.
Well, I don't know.
He says he came up with the name off the top of his head.
He's keeping his options open, but he does decide to do something other than detecting. He decides to play the violin.
Yeah, it's Holmes meets the Phantom of the Opera.
And what were your thoughts on that?
You know, I never liked the Phantom of the Opera. I read the book when I was rather young and did not care for it. And when the musical was super crazy popular, I suppose it actually took a few years for it to hit, but my mom was really into the music, so I like know all those damn songs without thinking about it. And I've never liked it. And every once in a while, like, it comes back into, like, the public consciousness, and suddenly I have to deal with it again. And every time it happens, I'm like, this is a stupid story. There's a little girl who's obsessed with a murderer who's running around in an opera killing people. I mean, he's the most terrifying, like, stalker in history, who's not only, like, terrifying because of how crazy he is, he's also terrifying because he's got, like, no face. And somehow women find this romantic. That, to me, is incredibly disturbing. And then, you know, I'm reading this book, and I was like, this is a different perspective on it. It's like, oh, the Phantom, he's really scary in this version of the story. I get that. That makes sense. Because, like, that version where he's romanticized, that doesn't work at all. I don't buy that for a second. And if I were in a position where I saw, like, the Phantom of the Opera as being an angel of music who was really interesting and alluring, I would be terrified. Because that's a monstrous psychology to manifest. And in this context, I finally understood why people liked Phantom of the Opera. It is a cool setting. It is a cool situation. Like you know, like the opera house and the location and, like, the sewer system. Like, I mean, France, it's thousands of years old. The people have been living there for, like thousands of years. It's fascinating. It's got a huge history, of underground history. It's all, like, present there in layers. It's like a civilization, you know, like, in geology. It's fascinating. And in this context, I get the appeal of it because I don't have to see it from that girl's point of view.
Well, I really didn't have much exposure to Phantom of the Opera at all. I had only seen the Joel Schumacher movie, and I did not like that one bit, so I don't really have much memory of it. But so I kind of went into this book with a clean slate. But I thought it was really good. This book, I mean, you know, I do think it is, you know, kind of atypical Holmes again, because you don't have Watson. But I think
that's the thing. I mean, there are lots of no Watson stories.
Maybe, but I had never read any of them, and you know, I think it worked quite well. But yeah, on the whole, I think this might be his best Holmes book.
I think that it is his best Holmes book. It definitely is. And it's also one of the few Holmes stories that doesn't feel... It doesn't feel like he's showing off. It feels like he's shown off at this point. He's like, I know what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. And by putting it in a novel, it actually, like, really felt like it was, like, expanding the universe in some really bizarre directions. Because, I mean, the previous books have sort of expanded into reality. And this one kind of, you know, tucks this novel into that then reality. And so it's a really interesting thing. And I wish he, you know, kept doing these, because I'd like to see what other crazy-ass things he could come up with.
So any final thoughts on Meyer's career? How would you sum it up, looking at, you know, his career as a novelist?
I think that when he wants to have fun, he does his best work. Because it seems that when he wants to be taken seriously, he kind of goes too far with taking things seriously. Because The Canary Trainer and West End Horror and even The 7% Solution, they are his most fun books, and he's having a lot of fun, more or less goofing off during the entirety of them. But they also show an extremely, you know, thorough researcher and a dedicated storyteller who really takes it seriously. When he is having fun, he's at his best. And when he seems to be not having fun or, you know, bearing his soul, he ends up kind of hitting the middle mark of quality.
Okay. I can kind of see what you're saying. I don't necessarily agree with that assessment, I think like it's in some ways I see it as kind of like, in a sense, Paul Thomas Anderson, I guess, where when he's got like a lot to say, he sort of throws some of the more tried and true formalistic qualities out the window in order to get down what he feels is important, you know, whereas with his sort of fluffier pieces, he can take those more simple ideas and just really focus on form, you know, just like nail that. I mean, it's a very, very fine line.
I know what you're saying, like sentence-wise, but I don't agree that either of those things are accomplished in anything he's ever done.
Okay, all right. Are you talking about Paul Thomas Anderson? Yes. Or Nicholas
Paul Thomas Anderson. I'm trying to imagine if like a fictional Paul Thomas Anderson mm-hmm. that you know made a good movie at some point, if like that really existed, like what the parallel would be with this. So I know what you're trying to say.
Okay, fine. For your purposes. Everyone else hopefully will know what I'm talking about, but for
I
your
swear
purposes,
to God, most people do not see Paul Thomas Anderson the way you see him.
Okay.
Most people see him as a fairly typical middle-of-the-road director.
Okay. I think you're completely wrong about that. But okay. For your purposes, let's just replace Paul Thomas Anderson with Steven Spielberg and just leave it at that.
That's inaccurate, too.
Okay.
Look, don't come up with another person to compare this to. I know what you're saying. You're saying that when he's got a lot to say, he goes overboard with the saying of it.
Okay.
All That's right. it. He doesn't know that what he's saying can be accomplished without saying all the words. Some sentences are best without all of the words added to them, because when you keep adding words to it in order to make your point about how important this sentence is, it ends up dragging on and on and on and never gets to the damn point, so you don't know what the point of the sentence was. Like a really long analogy involving Paul Thomas Anderson.
Okay, fine. Then let's wrap this up, shall we? My point is, I think that he is really good. I enjoyed every single one of his books. And the ones which I thought I would enjoy most were the ones which I thought were the best written, but didn't strike the strongest or the truest chord with me. So that pretty much wraps up Nicholas Meyer as a novelist. We're going to return to Nicholas Meyer next season. The first arc of our new season will be Nicholas Meyer as a director, but that'll be a few months down the road. In the meantime, we've got some cool things lined up. Up next, we've got a two-part series where we're going to be talking to Ron Wilkerson, the writer of for both Star Trek Next Generation and Star Trek Voyager. We're going to be talking about his career in Star Trek and his new book, The Ghost Writer. That's coming up next. So lots of stuff to look forward to. As always, you can find us at our other show at commentarytrackstars.com. You can find us on Twitter at ComTrackStars. You can email us at ComTrackStars@gmail.com. And I know I say that at the end of everything, but you know what? Write to us or tell us or something. Go to the Trek FM forums and tell us, you know, what you think of the show. If you have listened to this show and have never once tweeted us or anything just to say like, hey, I listened to your show, it's crap, do that. We'll take negative criticism. It's fine.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, we do want
to
hear from you.
And besides that, we take all silence as positive criticism. If you listen to it and don't say anything, I assume that means that you loved it.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, definitely, you know, get in touch with us. We will definitely respond to you. And if anyone out there is a fan of Harve Bennett, in particular The Invisible Man from the 70s starring David McCallum, or Time Tracks from the 90s starring I don't even know who.
Oh boy.
Let us know. If you want to talk to us, if you want to come on the show, you know.
Didn't you love the hologram on that show?
Get in touch with us. And
or that guy from the future?
And we'll try to work something out.
The sci-fi Nazis?
Yeah. So that's about it. Thanks for listening to us and our Nicholas Meyer thing, and we will be back next week with Ron Wilkerson talking about his work on Star Trek.